Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are journalist and novelist Margaret Wappler.
Hello there, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Pretty snazzy.
Good. We've also got pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Thompson.
Hey, Guy.
Hi, Rocketeers.
Hello, Karen.
Yes.
I don't know, just what's going on.
I mean, you know, things are going on. I'm dressed like I bought all my clothes from the professor's store today.
There's some mustard and black going on that caused me to say, go Steelers to Karen. I was really proud of myself. I actually said, go Phillies or Steelers or something like that, and then Margaret had to correct me. So we really have been able to mask a village here. We've also got two very special guests with us here. First off, we've got film critic and host of Max Fun's own Switchblade Sisters, April Wolf.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, April. What have you guys been talking about on Switchblade Sisters?
Oh, my God. A lot of horror stuff. We're definitely going to do some Drop Dead Gorgeous coming up soon.
Okay.
Ooh.
And we have a new player here tonight. It's author, poet, and scholar, S.A. Smythe. S.A., what should we know about you?
You know, I'm swimming in a sea of anxiety at all times, starting a new job at UCLA, and Love Murder, She Wrote.
Okay.
Well, you're also wearing a snazzy ensemble.
Oh,
very
thank you so much.
Ensemble.
Yeah. There is very dapper. There is a blazer going on with a shade of like a burgundy that
no,
we have.
No, another oxblood.
Well, it's actually oxblood. Thank you so much, Wappler.
Yes.
I really appreciate feeling seen in this room.
Thank you. All right. Now, I'm not going to be the one to do it. coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about the Doyenne of Cabot Cove, the remarkable Dame Angela Lansbury. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, even before we talk about what we're all about this week, do we want to talk at all about the fact that Pop Rocket Seal of Approval recipient Terry Crews came with some anachronistic beliefs about parenting this week on Twitter?
This is the profound risk. This is the high wire act of the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval, right? Because we, you know, it is a lifetime. We cannot revoke it from anyone. And we took so long to bestow it upon people.
But, I mean, what happened is Terry Crews said that children need a mother and a father in their lives. And he was trying to be generous about the idea of it can come from anywhere, but you need both of those energies. And it was just erasing of queer people, of people who try not to participate in that binary, of people who would,
single mothers.
Yeah, of people. I mean, the thing is, I feel like what he was saying was pitched to, yeah, you may have a single mother, but you'll find that father or like whatever. But like,
or that even you could find that paternal energy in someone else in your life.
Yeah.
But the way he framed it, I think, and also the way that Twitter allows things to just sort of be held in that character limit is, you know, you must have a patriarch, Luke.
Well, it's hard too because he dug himself into quite a hole in his responses to people. I do think he is a smart man and I do think he is open to learning. And so I hope he's having some really important conversations right now about, you know, what he said and how it sort of privileged a certain like hetero model.
I just think like we're fallible. We're human. Like to talk about things like this without having space for people making wrong choices and then learning. And he's someone who I think has a great capacity to learn and grow. And I believe that he will continue to do that. But the thing is like, I think that there's something very damaged about not acknowledging the change that has allowed the progress of the past 15 years, the past 10 years. Because like, as a queer person, most of the people who were voting to say I shouldn't have rights 10 years ago are still around and still voting. And things are a whole lot better for me. And I think that, you know, we shouldn't behave as though, oh, no, I was always on the right side of history. Like, no, we've all had to grow.
I guess all to say, I mean, you know, we can't take it away, but Terry Crews, you know, you gave us a nice little message when you received the PRSOA.
Yeah.
And I hope that you are going to hear us when we ask you to do better.
All right, you guys. Now, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. April, I turn to you as the one of our guest panelists who has been at this rodeo before. And I ask, what are you all about this week?
Well, I mean, I was watching TV and I saw a Gayle King interview and I was very into it.
So for TV news,
it was very good. It was very entertaining to me.
Who was she talking to?
She was talking to R. Kelly.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and, she's talking to everybody these days.
She is. And she's also, I think, negotiating for some big wage. You know, they're like, there's like a fight for her right now. And she really kind of proved her worth in this new interview, which I think is very entertaining to watch because she's really turning the screws on R. Kelly. He's got one woman who's just asking very direct questions, and he is just falling apart. And so that's the entertainment that I look forward to in my life. It's just like women asking direct questions and like watching bad people fall apart.
I say you're a smart person. What are you all about?
Well, I was thinking about this, and I was talking to Tonksin earlier about it, because usually when people say, what are you into? Insert contemporary popular culture thing. I usually go, oh, I haven't seen that. I only watch Murder, She Wrote. But here we are on a podcast talking about Murder, She Wrote. Yes. I got to be all about something else in addition to this. So recently moved, and in the wake of my move, I came upon Solange's new album, mm-hmm. When I Get Home, which just came out. So I want to say I'm all about that. And by that, I don't actually mean the album. I actually mean the reception around it, which is people that I've seen on social media basically freaking out about how it's not a seat at the table and it's not the Solange that we quote-unquote knew. Mm-hmm. So I'm really all about the social media come apart of a Black woman sort of developing her craft and trying new avenues.
Margaret Wappler, what are you all about this week?
I am all about the Game of Thrones trailer for the final season. I am ready for this season to come upon me. The new season is going to debut April 14th. And immediately the nerds were like, okay, this trailer's too dark. It's actually just like not, I don't mean in tone. I just mean in like visual darkness. Like, so a bunch of people uploaded their lightened versions on Reddit.
So that
all of us nerds could like spot characters in the background.
I mean,
and
in the winter that never ends, it will be dark all the time.
It's true. I think there were some very promising sights in the trailer. Like, for instance, Arya looks genuinely frightened in a way that she hasn't for a long time, because she's always been this like vengeful, bloodthirsty little girl that just wants to get revenge.
Yeah.
Do you watch?
So again, I only watched Murder, She Wrote, but I just wanted to say that I did see the trailer and I definitely saw the Reddit lightened version, and thank you so much to whoever did that.
Right,
because
it helped.
Otherwise she's in a series of corridors. You know, I saw her on a Doctor Who episode. I don't know what's going on. I stopped when
a Doctor
Greyjoy...
Who episode. I thought you only watched Murder, She Wrote.
I know, I've shamed my people. Those are the two shows. I'm so sorry.
I like the idea that you have theories that allow for a broadened definition of Murder, She Wrote, that says that the Hooniverse and the Game of Thrones trailer are parts of the extended
universe. Actually the same universe. Yeah. I'm sorry, whenever you see Jessica Fletcher, there's going to be a dead body around. Whenever you see the Doctor, someone's getting got. It could be an alien, it could be a pet, be a companion. They're gone.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, I'm just going to say a few more of my wishes. My wishes for this upcoming season is that Sansa gets really, really powerful, but not evil. Uh-huh. I don't want her to go full-blown evil. And when I interviewed Richard Madden recently, you know, he's the person that played Robb Stark, and he's not on the show obviously anymore, but he's still friends with a lot of them. And so I really tried to get from him like any hints, any clues, whatever that they've dropped to him. And he was like, no, I don't know anything. I don't know anything. But at one point he just let like a tiny drop of blood land on the table in the form of, well, Sansa is her mother's daughter. And I was like, chin stroke, what does this mean?
Yeah.
Tonksin,
what are you all about this week?
A real palate cleanser of the kind of insane world that we live in that, like, vacillates between, you know, Michael Cohen one day, Michael Jackson the next day, Terry Crews fucking up the third or fourth day. Anyway, this is such a delight, and it is in the idiom of feel-good reality television, the kind which our own dear Margaret Wappler has written about.
Yes.
And it is the big family cooking showdown. It's on Netflix. But it's a British show, and it's really about these little family configurations. It can be a husband and wife and their random cousin, or grandma and like a boyfriend and a girlfriend, or, you know, whomever. Like, it's like a kind of loose definition of family, but it's teams of three who compete in a reality competition show, basically cooking various meals in these challenges that are in a similar structure to the Bake Off, where there are two challenges per episode. And it has new host this season. I talked about this show before when it was in its first season, but it seems like a long time ago since they released one here to us in the U.S. And in the second season, there are new hosts, Celebrity MasterChef winner Angelica Bell, who one of my favorite contestants, who's named, and this is a great name, I'm Empire Abimbola Young. Oh. Calls her Angelico. And there's also the other host, Tommy Banks, who's Britain's youngest Michelin-starred chef. And he's very much in the Chris Prattian vein of, like, you know, he is like a human beef Wellington. he's just like all like meat and then a like layer of pastry over it. I feel like that's like British masculinity in a nutshell.
Yeah, it really is.
Right? And so this season is so much fun. And in part because I think about it in the frame of, you know, kind of the British people grappling with Brexit. Like, I think that there's so much about these British reality competition cooking shows that are trying to deal with, like, a very assertive about a narrative about how British taste, British culture has benefited from the forms of diversity and the different diasporas that have landed in a post-colonial world there.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's so many amazing families. There are, of course, two families named White. One is from Hampshire and the other is Scottish. And one of them, I will say, no spoilers, but they make basically, they're supposed to create this elaborate feast that's supposed to be really hard to make. And they just basically make it like a Mexican taco bar with like ground meat and like some homemade guac. And I was like, this is brilliant. And I'm just like, this is a cultural difference. And
guac
so hard.
This is like guacamole is very difficult. And then
you nailed the accent there.
Yeah,
cheers.
There's like the mysteries. The mysteries are like a South Asian family who are doing awesome stuff. I'm over-identified personally with the Whitakers, because they are this, there's white dad, Asian mom, Hapa kid. I'm not like biologically Hapa, but I was raised so. And they basically lived in all these different hotels in Southeast Asia. And like, and that was like totally my life as a kid. And I don't know. It's just like, I'm so like team Whitakers. Anyway, watch it if you need a palate cleanser from the world. It's really great.
That sounds very compelling.
Yeah.
I need to go in on that. This week, I am all about Wade Robson and James Safechuck and Bianca Francia from the Leaving Neverland documentary, because I hadn't really paid much attention to the documentaries and interviews that we have done with Michael Jackson so far, but it was really interesting to watch two men who had previously testified that they did not have sexual encounters with Michael Jackson. Now, as men in their 30s, talk about what did happen and why they didn't talk about it. And, like, the ambiguity that was there was something I didn't understand. And I think it helped me to understand people who were sexually abused as children a lot better. And then sort of the figure at the edge of the documentary, it's really just like, it's mostly interviews. There is some documentary stuff going on, but it's mostly just those interviews. But the person at the edge is Bianca Francia, who is the one maid at Neverland who attempted to alert authorities to what was going on. And I think it's so interesting the number of people who we have put forward as people who are capable of commenting on this, and that she is a figure we haven't really talked about, even though, you know, CNN conversations from like the investigations and the lawsuit in the 90s and the investigation in the 2000s always mentioned a maid, but this was never a person given personhood. This is never somebody who got to sit down with Barbara Walters and talk about what she experienced. And it was terrifying to learn this about it's also just so steeped in childhood when I was a child. Like, Michael Jackson's gross caricature of what children want was very much targeted towards a boy my age in like a post Silver Spoons world. And
the train, the little train around the track.
Yeah. And watching the dynamics and watching, you know, there was an article in Slate that said that the documentary was unfair to the mothers. And it really does, like, you know, it talks about the complex relationship that these guys have with their moms because they were there and did not interfere with this stuff happening.
And they helped facilitate to a certain extent the closeness that Michael had with them.
Well, the fascinating thing, because Karen, you also watched the documentary, yes, right? Did either of you guys?
No.
The thing is you start to smell the edges of, because what they talk about is Michael Jackson, he would get really into a boy, and then 12 months later, he would get really into a new boy, but then the other boys were still allowed to, like, come around and stuff, and you had this sense of, like, competition, that, like, people were playing to be, you know, most beloved concubine about a seven-year-old boy, and it was truly horrifying, and watching men have to deal with the complexity of their emotions. Like, James Safechuck talks about a wedding ceremony that Michael Jackson had with him, and his emotions around it are so complex, is a thing I will never understand. And it was like it was horrifying, but it is good to understand better just how this affects people into adulthood.
I would say that, you know, one of the things that's striking to me kind of in the aftermath is the Oprah interview, actually, and Oprah's own kind of, I guess, verification or endorsement of the way that this story or their stories were told, given the tremendous blowback, given a lot of skepticism and stuff that I wanted to take seriously because it is like very different communities who aren't just Michael Jackson stans, but there are a lot of people who've also talked about like the kind of racialization of how these things were described in the documentary and whatnot. But Oprah's own experience and her own framing of it through her experience as a survivor, and in addition to the, you know, just like I have someone very close to me in my life who is who was sexually abused at a young age as a boy and didn't speak about it for decades.
Yeah.
And the way, like, watching that documentary gave to, like, basically replicated the experience of speaking to this person in my life.
Yeah.
And I understand, like, all of the conspiracy theories floating around and, like, that people don't want to believe it and all this stuff. And, like, there are legitimate reasons to kind of question the way in which these stories are framed, especially around race, especially, you know, around a family like the Jacksons. But I was just like, that's not something that you can make up. That's not an affect. Like, they would have to be tremendous actors to do that. They you know, like, there's all this stuff about, like, how Safechuck, like, is stealing some other boy's story that was in a biography. But I was just like, you know, like, actually, that's not the kind of shit that you can fake. That's not the kind of shit that you can, like, make up in you know, when you're talking to people about this. Well, and it resembles what I've heard from and how I've experienced someone talking to me about it.
All right. When we come back, we're going to talk about Angela Lansbury. You're yes. Listening to Pop Rock.
Oh, something completely different.
Welcome back, and thank you, Dan, for that scathing report. As you know, Max Fun Drive is coming up March 18th to March 29th, which has some folks pretty excited. But as families around the world get ready to celebrate this season of giving, community, and quality podcasts, some are wondering if it's just too much.
Are they, though?
They are. Some people are all for comedy and culture, but with 45 shows offering hundreds of hours of bonus content, plus all the Max Fun meetups taking place around the world, some people think it's too much.
While other people think it sounds totally awesome.
I took my granddaughter to the mall to get her picture taken, and the mall pod fairy was short. And I, you know, I'm just gonna say it, I'm sorry, but everyone knows the pod fairy is tall.
Well, I think we should just leave it there. Until next time, here's the news you need to know. Max Fun Drive runs from March 18th through 29th. Be sure to listen to all of your favorite podcasts. I know I will.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Margaret Wappler.
Karen Tongson.
April Smythe.
Oh. We're the same.
Jinx, you guys owe each other a beverage.
Okay, I like bourbon.
You guys, we brought the two of you in as heavy hitters because this week we are talking about Dame Angela Lansbury. I mean, 75 years worth of career, 3 Oscar nominations, 6 Tonys, 55 nominations, the original mayoress in Anyone Can Whistle. And I just, you know, with somebody who's had a career this long, I have to ask you, April, what was the first Angela Lansbury you encountered?
The first one was most certainly Murder, She Wrote, because I was coming of age in the 80s and it was on for, you know, every single week for so many years of my youth. And I lived with my grandparents. They raised me. And so I watched it with my grandmother. And we certainly bonded over it. It was, yeah. But then I got into classic film when I was a kid. So Picture of Dorian Gray and Gaslight were the
next.
Did
it give you an accurate... Do you feel like getting to know her as Jessica Fletcher gave you an accurate or inaccurate representation of what Angela Lansbury was?
I would say the more that I learned about her, inaccurate, but there's definitely parts of her that are in that, but there's a kind of prudishness that her character, Jessica has that is not necessarily present in what Angela, like, she's a very kind of spicy woman, we'll
she's
say.
She's a ribald.
Yeah.
Say, what about you?
I definitely also say Murder, She Wrote, which aired 2 weeks after my birthday, my literal birthday.
Yeah, you're young. I was expecting some Mrs. Potts action from you, frankly.
Thank you so much. It really doesn't crack, like they say. But also my grandmother, who went to school with Dame Angela Lansbury, my grandmother, who is white, so if you're hearing this, that's the only way, because of segregation. So, they went to a couple years in different classes. Angela was... Dame Angela, I'm so sorry. Slightly older, went to House Southampstead in London for a couple of years. And actually, that's how I got to meet her, which maybe is a story I can tell later or never. It's fine.
That's so fucking insane already.
Oh, thank you so much. So, old people, olden times, used to write letters to each other. My grandmother's no longer here, so I don't know how to explain how she got her address. But when she became a dame, my grandmother wrote her a note. You know, in the times that people used to write, like, little thank you on, like, index cards and say, like, oh, you know, dear so-and-so, hope all's well, little card, or thank you for the dinner party. my grandmother wrote to her, and so I, you know, my PhD is from the Bay Area, South Bay, and so I've been in the U.S. for quite some time, lived in New York for quite some time, was going back and forth between U.S. and Europe, and on my way one of the summers when Dame Angela Lansbury was reprising No Cowards Blithe Spirit, my grandmother was like, oh, do you want to go? And I've got us tickets. And I was like, this is too much U.S. time, because I was like, shut up. And she went, I will not. I was like, well, no, of course not. I mean, I respect you. Thank you so much for raising me. I really appreciate it. But how did you do that? She was like, oh, you know, Angie sent me, she called her Angie, you know, send us a few tickets. And I was like, how did that happen? And it turns out when she wrote this, and again, I don't know how she got, how you just write, like, to Santa Claus, right? You write Angela Lansbury and you just send it in the post and then it arrives to her doorstep. I don't understand. But she wrote, you know, congratulations on your dameship, like, congratulations on this. And then she wrote back a handwritten letter saying, oh, thank you so much, Madge, which is my grandmother's, like, was a nickname. Thank you so much. I hope all is well as you and yours. I'm you know, I'm in a little show. I hope you please find and close these.
Show. A little.
Listen, I'm again first so podcast, so I'm like, am I screeching already? I told myself I wouldn't like just freak out, but you know, I just was, you know, trying to contain myself because my grandmother, very repressed white Welsh lady, was just trying to keep it together, you know, because she doesn't, you know, deal with emotions. We stiff up her lip, etc. And so I got the tickets. I was on my way to South Africa. It was 2014. For some research, I was working with another iconic Angela, which is Angela Davis. So I changed my ticket. It's actually quite easy to go from.
She's also great in MAME. A lot of people don't know.
Angela Davis, fantastic in MAME.
She embodied. Man,
Bosom
MAME.
Buddies had this like racial connotation that no one had foreseen. It was really beautiful.
She and Cicely Tyson were just like, just why like, not?
Wow, this is incredible. Let's just do it. Let's be Bosom Buddies post incarceration.
And then you met her.
Yes. So I came very jet lagged, New York to London, because I had changed my flight last minute. It was a terrible flight, but I just needed to make the show. So I was picked up at the airport, got to go to the theater because she was in London before San Francisco. And so I was disheveled and jet lagged. And my grandmother, you know, I'm ashamed of my family. Definitely the dark horse, literally the black person, and also very queer. And so I showed up and she went, oh, that's what you're wearing. My grandmother, not the sweet, sweet dame. And we got tickets. We saw the show. I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. She was reprising her role, Madame Arcati. And then at the end, an usher came up to us and was like, okay, if you'd like to go to the back. Because what she had done was, you know, the seats that she gave us, like we were on the little list, yeah. So we can go to the back. And so that's what happened. The usher took us and I was like, I'm not wearing the right outfit. I'm not wearing the right, if I had that Oxford blazer, you know, Wobbler?
Right, like
if
you I could was, have gone anywhere with
man,
that.
Man, she'd be so impressed. Mm-hmm. I'm friends to this day. But instead, so we go to the back, I'm like exhausted and like freaking, my palms are sweating. My grandmother seems to be like unflappable, like not really moved. Like, of course, this is what happens next. But I'm like, my grandmother who, you know, made me watch the show and like this is how I learned about her. And I, you know, thought of her as like a secondary grandmother. I had this whole life with her in my head as a yeah. child. My grandmother didn't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm there like really fanning and she's like, oh, yes, Angie, it's you. And they gave a little hug. And then so I see her. She's much taller than I didn't use Wiki. I don't know. Uh-huh. She's taller than I expected. And so I'm looking up and she's like, would you like a cup of tea? And then I start bawling. I'm like tired. I'm a little emotional. I just start openly weeping. And then my grandmother is like burying her head in shame. She's like,
You British people are cool with showing emotion publicly like that.
Yeah, right? No, yeah. That's all we do. We're like a really emotional bunch. Just feelings nonstop. And so she starts to apologize, my grandmother, for me. And then the dame holds my shoulder and then she's like, I think she's perfect the way she is. And then aww. I start doing the like disgusting like snot bawling and then it made it worse. Then, so we had the cup of tea. They started like catching up. They only overlapped for like two years.
Yeah.
So they started talking about that and I just like exited. And I was like, actually, I realized, you know, when people say don't meet your heroes, it's actually worse. It was like, I don't want her to remember me like this. So I just like stepped out and that's sort of the end. I waited outside, I chain smoked and like that was sort of the end.
That's magical.
Yeah.
I have a question. Okay, so your grandmother obviously went to school in London or Britain,
yes.
right? So
yes.
Angela Lansbury had to leave because of the Blitz. Mm-hmm. So she was able to get a spot in America to escape the World War II that was coming into London.
The UK, yeah.
So, I mean, your grandmother probably also left.
Went to Wales. Yeah, because she is Welsh, or was Welsh, so just went back, basically out west, where nobody wanted to bomb because the sheep are not really worth getting got, you know?
Yeah, it's a weird thing. Whenever I say, like, actually, Angela Lansbury is a refugee, and people are like, what? Yeah. Like, she's a white refugee, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, that's...
Well, how do you get displaced by a war and then end up in Gaslight at 18?
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, she wasn't working for a department store, and they were like, we'll pay you more if you stay at the department store. And she's like, actually, can you? She almost stayed at the department store because Gaslight wasn't paying her a lot.
Margaret, who is your favorite Angela Lansbury?
It's Jessica Fletcher. I mean, it's the first one.
I was
one
looking for an
too.
Answer other than Jessica
I know,
Fletcher.
Everybody's and I just cannot. Saying, well, I mean, okay.
That's
my
fair,
second,
though. Yes.
Let me say my second favorite, which is a very worthy Angela to bring up, and that is evil Angela Lansbury yes. from Manchurian Candidate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, one time on The Tonight Show, she said, like, men get to play King Lear. I will never get to play King Lear. Mm-hmm. But the Manchurian Candidate, that was my King Lear.
You are to shoot the presidential nominee through the head. And Johnny will rise gallantly to his feet and lift Ben Arthur's body in his arms, stand in front of the microphones and begin to speak. The speech is short, but it's the most rousing speech I've ever read. It's been worked on here and in Russia on and off for over 8 years. I shall force someone to take the body away from him. Then Johnny will really hit those microphones and those cameras with blood all over him, fighting off anyone who tries to help him, defending America even if it means his own death, rallying a nation of television viewers into hysteria to sweep us up into the White House with powers that will make martial law seem like anarchy.
If you just only could see these fanjoys, these fans
one take. When is Bo and Yang gonna get on that stage?
We should send a request.
Yeah. We should.
But also, I have to say though, one of the things from hearing that and just thinking about, like, you could just arc Angela Lansbury's career through her vocality.
Mm. Yeah.
The way that she uses her voice so differently in so many of her roles. It's like, you know, because I think I know that I'm not the youngest one here by far. In fact, I think I'm the oldest one here. But, you know, beyond Jessica Fletcher, my experience of Angela Lansbury was like, tale as old as time. True as it can be. Barely even friends, then somebody bends unexpectedly. Mrs. Potts.
Can
you know?
I also say that she did that in one take as well.
Also one take.
So single take.
One
single take.
Queen.
Single take dame.
But but just thinking about that, you know, that there's a that she veers easily in and out of that Britishness, mm-hmm. of the accentedness, and there is that, like, kind of theatrical enunciation that you get from especially her film roles through the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah.
Sure, I'd be very pleased to do anything I can, sir. Will that be all you're wanting?
Yes, except tea when it's ready.
Very good, sir.
And then you get, like, later on, this just sort of, like, you know, quizzical and more understated version of herself. And when she's doing musical theater, you get all of these other different Angela Lansbury voices, you know, the you know, from Sweeney Todd and just sort of, like, you know, to all of these roles where she just basically has, like, some other iteration of herself that,
yeah, she's,
you know,
not just singing, she's telling a story with her voice and acting as she's singing, and there's just a shortage of people who can act as they sing, and that's, it's just,
and I mean, going from the broadness of what's her name, and I was trying to remember Vera Charles so hard that I forgot the name of the pie making lady, Mrs.
Lovett.
Ah, customer. What you rush, what you hurry? You gave me such a fright. I thought you was a ghost half a minute. Can't you sit you down, sit? All I meant is that I haven't seen a customer for weeks. Did you come here for a pie, sir? Do forgive me if me head's a little vague. What is that? But you think we have a plague? From the way that people...
Going from the broadness of Mrs. Lovett to, like, you know, the faux sophistication of Vera Charles in MAME.
I feel it's my duty to tell you it's time to adjust to your age. You try to be peg of my heart when you're Lady Macbeth. Exactly. How old are you, Vera? The truth.
How old do you think?
Oh, I'd say somewhere between 40 and death.
She is somebody who has the confidence, but the acting, she's an actor first and a singer second, but she's a good enough singer that you're never like, ouch, how is this gonna go? You're always just in it. And, like, it's so sad that we did not get her Vera Charles in the film of Mame.
Yes.
Like
I just want to say that she didn't know how to sing correctly. So before she got Mame, she had to take singing lessons and had to prove herself because they would not let her on. And she had to do like cattle call stuff to get this role of Mame, and like dropped everything in LA, moved out to New York, and was just like, this is what I have to do. I feel my calling. So when she didn't get the movie thing, and when Lucille Ball, like, who she also respected, fought for that role, it was so crushing to her that still today she feels terrible about it.
I love that the 60s and 70s are just stories of them recasting the musical on film to try to make it more marketable, and those always being magnificent failure.
Yes. And she was dubbed constantly in her early career. We were talking about that earlier, SA and I, where she would sometimes dub other singers, but most of the time she herself was dubbed. Yeah.
So was she dubbed in Dorian Gray?
No. And you'll see, I mean, we've got a clip of that too. She's got that kind of like thin, pretty voice that we end up hearing later on in Beauty and the Beast too.
Can we hear that? Dame Angela's Sybil Vane.
Goodbye, Little Yellow Bird.
The snow was very plentiful, and crumbs were very few, when a weather-beaten sparrow through a mansion window flew.
I'm so glad there are no cameras here. I'm going to be honest.
I mean, I would love it. Just a documentary of just us talking about Murder, She Wrote is something that I would keepsake forever.
Every time you throw it to a clip, I'm just like embodying the music.
Song she sings in a later episode in Murder, She Wrote, and it comes back, and she had all these fan letters who were fans of the picture of Dorian Gray were just like, thank you for singing that song
you did that for us.
Yeah. And she was kind of a pioneer a little bit in sort of being respected film actress, like hardcore downshifting, and you know, in the early 80s launching this like, you know, TV franchise that would go on for like 10 seasons. Like, it's such a big
more
12 like, I mean, four made for TV films.
Yeah. 264
episodes. It's like, do you feel like that was a waste of her talents, or do you feel like it was a form that allowed us to get more of her?
Have you seen her performances?
They are great. I also think that it opened her up to a whole generation of fans that wouldn't have known about her.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people watched it with their grandparents or an older family member, and it was like a cozy, sweet thing to watch. And like, also, I know that Murder, She Wrote was like a real family affair. Like, she had one of her brothers like was in the writer's room. Mm-hmm. Like, I think her husband was somehow involved too.
And her son groomed him to be a producer, and
I never watched that much of it. I watched a first season episode in preparation for today. Like, it's so lovely. It's also a job that she can slide through. She's doing so many reaction shots and so many just sort of like, I noticed that briefcase shots.
Yes, that is the thing that struck me. Like, I rewatched this Night of the Tarantula episode from season 6.
Which on S.A. Smythe's recommendation.
Yes, which I hope we get to talk about it a little bit because...
I'm ready.
Because, you know, when I watched that episode, I was just like, I mean, there's so many other people who are flexing and doing so much like acting and hard labor and accents and the whole deal. And basically she gets to sort of stand around in semi-fabulous outfits and kind of look quizzically at people at various moments and like whip a doily out at the opportune moment to try to slip a key under a door. And you're like, well, that, you know, we're here, that she's like our anchor in this, you know, menagerie of overacting people.
When you watch enough of it, you start to know who the directors and the writers are. And you know, when you see, for me, it's John Llewellyn Moxie. So when I see a John Llewellyn Moxie movie episode, I know that Angela's going to get to do better acting. Mm-hmm. And he is really great at kind of focusing the camera on her face and asking her to emote a little bit more. And he is okay with moments of stillness in a way that, you know, other directors aren't, and there's subtlety in his. This is Vincent McElveedy, and he is a veteran of TV shows Diagnosis Murder. He was on Columbo, which a lot of people kind of went back and forth between Columbo and Murder, She Wrote at the time. But he is more of the, you know, like the by-the-books campy stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's what you're getting here, where it's just like people are on 11, you know?
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
and those are it's fun to watch different episodes back to back that are directed by different people because it's a different show on each mm-hmm. one.
Yeah.
I love it.
There's something about Angela Lansbury that both attracts and repels me. She reminds me a lot of my mother, so I'm at once like endeared to her. And attracted to her and like want to hug her, but I also find her like annoying. Like,
oh my God, she's so fucking annoying.
Yeah,
yes.
And she's so judgmental. That judgmental look that she has
that
all the
quizzical,
time.
The upper eyebrow.
Oh yeah. Fuck. I mean,
okay, I live for it.
She's always judging, but she never actually like says it. She always says something like gracious and smile.
She's so passive aggressive.
Yes.
There is a condescending pursing of the lips that happens a lot.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's why I asked the question about, do you think it did a disservice to her? Because as a kid who grew up watching like occasional Murder, She Wrote without trying to, when I saw her as Eglantine in Bedknobs mm-hmm. and Broomsticks,
yeah.
as a super efficient witch with a little bit of a sense of humor, like I was like, hey, wait,
right?
Who could this lady be? You know?
Mm-hmm. But I mean, I actually have to say that, you know, Murder, She Wrote is definitely my entrance, but when I was hooked, I was hooked. And actually, what let me appreciate Murder, She Wrote, Jessica Fletcher, more is actually the fact that she's a total bitch. It's not just evil, you know, Manchurian candidate Angela Lansbury. It's her even in MAME. It's her, you know, in Sweeney Todd. It's her in a lot of, even her smaller B-roles in like when she was contracted with MGM. It's actually all of these little parts where she's contractually obligated to play people people's mums, even yeah. though they're peers in real life, where she's playing these roles of like someone who's not just, it's not Midwest actually, and so it's like a haughtier than thou, I've already done that, been there, better, nailed it, turned around in heels, sung a little ditty and like went to bed, right? That so that when she is actually Jessica Fletcher, what I actually was seduced by is, first of all, what I quickly noted is how many people are trying to basically sleep with her or like romance her in
all
the show.
The
so she's actually time. Still playing the queen bee. For me, I mean, I don't know your Midwest moms, which I mean, gracious, but the fact that people were all, you know, of a certain age, men of a certain age, were constantly trying to mac, and then she would kind of demurely, with a hint of passive aggression, but also like, I know I could better than that. I'll see you. You know, I'm here deducing somewhere, where she would sort of like turn on her heels and like go and then ride a bike because she didn't know how to drive in the show. I mean, I was very much seduced by this classy way of being able to say, I know, and no thanks,
well,
right? And she could only do that role if she were, like, a total bitch previously in this quote-unquote Second Life show on CBS.
Yeah.
Like, the episode I watched, Murder on a Bus, was, like, a very self-contained, like, a stage play. I mean, it's essentially Murder on the Orient Express, but on a bus.
Yeah, it's like coach.
But,
Cabot Cove.
You guys talking about Jamaica just made me remember how much there was this faux travel that happened on 80s hour-longs, that there really was a lot of B-roll of luxurious places that we were used to from Fantasy Island and The Love Boat, and then it got into Magnum P.I. and Riptide and, you know, mm-hmm. Let's Solve a Crime in a Sexy Place, that eventually became Miami Vice. Angela Lansbury as the star of Miami Vice. I mean, I think we should figure out how to make that happen.
She would really fucking rock a blazer, I'll tell you
that. I would love to be her partner. If she's like, I can
tubs.
Drive. I will drive. I'll wear my glasses and I'll drive. I just want to say also that Murder, She Wrote, you know, it was one of those shows where people were like, why would anyone watch this older woman solve crimes? I think it was in the 10th season where they kept asking her to come back. The 10th season, I think Steven Spielberg had his amazing stories that he premiered, and everyone's just like, oh, fuck, it's going to blow her out of the water, whatever. And no one watched Steven Spielberg's show.
Yeah.
Every single person was watching the season premiere of Murder, She Wrote, and she destroyed him, and he got canceled.
Yeah.
Like, because they thought that they could go up against, they were like, we'll slot him at this point because we're going to get the younger crowd and all that. They don't want to watch Murder, She Wrote, but she destroyed him. And
crushed him.
I would love to ask him that question someday. I'm just like, how did it feel to get creamed by Angela Lansbury?
One of the things was, the children these days will never understand what day parts were the way that we do.
Yeah.
But the fact that it was Sunday night made it, I don't know what experience you were having of it in Britain. That
thank
is,
you so much. 4:20 p.m. on Thursdays.
Stoner
time?
Okay.
Ridiculous.
Oh,
but no, like,
oh gosh, okay.
Murder, That's She right. Wrote should be consumed at, was it 9 o'clock on
yes.
Sunday night.
Prime time.
And it was just sort of like this, all right, guys, you're going to have to go to school or work tomorrow. This weekend is over, but like just have this beef stew of a TV show.
Yes, right. It goes down easy. It's not going to trouble you. Yeah. You get to ponder over the clues, but not in a really stressful way.
Didn't it make you feel good? When I'm depressed, I mean, I obviously own the box set, as Essay does too.
That's true.
And I turn it on when I'm feeling depressed. Like I was really, really depressed in January with a bunch of job stuff. And I was just like laying in bed. My husband just puts on a DVD. I didn't even ask. And I was just like, oh, and I just felt better after I watched like 4 episodes, you know? I know, right?
One thing that was interesting to me, because I did a revisit of sort of like crime shows of the 80s a while ago. When you watch Heart to Heart, you know who did it. And you're seeing cutaways of all of that stuff.
And Columbo too.
Columbo, yeah.
And like Murder, She Wrote was in being a throwback to Poirot or, you know, Miss Marple, it was also a forerunner of the sort of like, can I solve this along with them? And like the way that Murder, She Wrote underlines clues in such a beautiful way so that you can be like, ah, his name is Gadsby or whatever. Like, it's just, it's so corny, but also so good because you're playing, it's a game, you know?
Well, the Night of the Tarantula, and I don't know, I have to ask the Fansburys about this, is that, like, it struck me as a bit of a Scooby-Doo type scenario, you know, where there's, like, you know, there's some mysticism and, like, ghostliness and all this stuff. I don't believe that the other episodes of Murder, She Wrote were like that, but did it just become more Scooby-Doo because it was, like, not in America?
Can't stress enough that every episode is different.
Yeah.
Like, this is more of a Scooby-Doo kind of thing is what I would say, but you can watch a more serious one or, you know, like you can watch one that fits your mood, right, Essay?
Yeah, definitely. There are ones that have like, I mean, right, April, they're like has real heartbreak, right? There's some where she's solving the crime and then the person, because usually, right, she's in the name of justice, and we can talk about the prison industrial complex, you know, April and I talked about it earlier, but, you know, because she is trying to get something solved, but it's actually even in that sense, it's often like to acquit someone who was falsely accused, right? She's not out there just trying to be a vigilante and like solve a crime before police. It's usually someone who is usually oppressed in some way or impoverished that she's trying to like support and say, this person did not do it. I'm going to find out who did to like have the accurate culprit so that this person who's often like a single mom or a relative or something like this. But there are cases, you know, I can't even think of the episode now, but there are a couple, one or two where someone who she was trying to support or she was a long-term friend of, right, winds up being the killer and is like, Jess, here's why I had to do it. And then the, you know, the closing scene where she just looks like, oh, devastated. Like, how could it be you? Like, we're better than this kind of thing. And then it like fades out. Yeah. There's some that are like a lot more like quirky and like light, or like someone just died and like 3 people were murdered and like 1 person was just sent to prison and she's like, well, I guess I won't be back to Miami anytime soon, and then it like freeze frame and she's like and then the theme song comes on.
Yeah,
it's wildly divergent emotionally speaking.
And
there's
even
a range.
Like the first few, her husband Frank dies, right? Mm-hmm. So she's a widow, no children,
doc,
retired school
substitute teacher. Yeah.
But there are moments when she's recalling Frank where there's just like, it genuinely brings tears to my eyes when I'm like, oh, she's a fucking great performer. Where like you can just kind of in the middle of this episode about this, you can just drop in this emotion. There's one where she doesn't even, there's only one episode where she doesn't completely solve the crime, and it hits and it nips at her brain so much, and you can see it, like she's agitated through to the end. And it, like the freeze frame is just her being like, oh
some
God, I hope what I did was okay.
That's wonderful.
I do have a lot of women of color friends, people of color friends who love Murder, She Wrote. And, you know, one of my first questions is just like, well, what do you see in this? Because it's a different way to look at it. You know, it's a white savior complex of a show.
You know, the academic in me is like, well, you know, there is this thing about disidentification where you see a thing. I mean, first of all, I mean, I know, you know, Karen, you've talked about this in different ways on this very show, right? Where you like, you know, you can enjoy what you enjoy, because constantly being underrepresented in media broadly, you're like, well, I still enjoy this thing. What I definitely see out of this show, Initially, what I saw out of it was, you know, my grandmother's kind of people.
Yeah.
Because I was left by myself in a generation where, or in a place where children should be seen and not heard. My grandmother had a rosary club. We didn't have a television in our house, but she would go over and, like, gossip over tea with the other ladies, and they had television. Murder, She Wrote was on. I was glued to it because that's when I could watch TV. Mm. So I had a different kind of attachment to it, also knowing my grandmother and who she was. But later on, actually watching the show, what I was saying before this is I really appreciated, actually, especially into adulthood, how women of a certain age were casted. Also, I mean, in the Night of Tarantula episode, which, man, if people who haven't seen the episode watch it, I, a black person, having recommended the show, I understand that it's a problem. I grew up partly in Jamaica. I am so sorry. That is not the first episode that people should necessarily watch, especially in the age of, like, things being woke or problematic or not. But me, having grown up a bit in Jamaica, and, like, that's not the Jamaica, that's not any Jamaica that I knew, but I really appreciated the, like, bloviating John Rhys Davies, or, like, bloviating racist, which is a kind of a feature, a stalwart in the show, where someone is, like, just directly out of pocket, and then you have the very quizzical Angela.
Sorry, I haven't watched the episode, but the wonderful thing of, like, of course John Rhys Davies is in it. It's like, of course.
That's right.
It's the crumbling empire. What will we do without
him? He's just there bloviating. He goes, you know, when someone picks up the, you know, I think his wife, right, hands him the phone, and or he picks up the phone, and he goes to his wife and he's like,
"There's a totally confused fellow called Reggie on the phone, wants to talk to you about the party."
"Reggie? Oh, you must mean reggae, not Reggie. As in reggae music."
"Oh, Reggie. You would have imagined after all these years of being ruled by the British that these people would have learned to speak the Queen's English."
"Well, to tell you the truth, I've heard the same complaints made about us Americans."
I'm watching the show like, oh my God, thank you so much for being like, it's a gentle, you know, middle class sort of pushback instead of being like, I'm going to call you out. You're racist. Like, she's there on, you know.
Yeah, he'll realize 2 hours later that he got caught.
Yep.
He was beheaded.
Here's my question for you.
He got caught.
When you were watching it as a child, did that feel American to you? Or did it just feel like, nah, like indiscriminate small town?
Yeah, it actually just looked like a world I'd, you know, never really seen. It had a coast. I wasn't really sure. I wasn't, like, necessarily placing it. Never heard of Maine. I don't know if Americans have heard of Maine. Fair. But, like, no, I mean, I'm just like, what is it? I don't understand.
Like Stephen King's home?
Yeah, I mean, right? There's like a house and it kind of closes on you or something. Yeah. So, no, I hadn't really seen it. But what was really, so what was drawn to me is, like, her, which, you know, I'm not, at this point, who works on colonialism, I'm not the person to sort of knock, just to sort of say, like, oh, it's, like, you know, barred from critique. It's definitely a show about colonial benevolence, right? But I still really very much appreciate now what I just was seduced by earlier, which is, like April mentioned, her history around socialism and leftist politics, right? So in her very middle-class white way, she definitely, in the show, and also in the life of the show, but also in the casting of women who were supposed to be like has-beens in media, definitely tried to cast these people, right? There's the younger ones are supposed to be the ditzy people, but these older women who were not castable anywhere else were like, oh, you have a life and a backstory and sense.
And one woman in particular, a woman that she used to work with, because we could talk forever about the character actors in the show, she was very sick. And she couldn't afford health care, and she couldn't get health care unless she was working. And so,
oh God damn!
And so, Angela Lansbury, what's that?
Was it the hairdresser?
No,
was her?
No. She wrote her a part, and she had a three or four episode arc, and was just kind of a character in Cabot Cove, so that she could get health insurance.
Get them SAG credits.
Yeah, exactly. Like Angela Lansbury did that for her, and she ended up having a great role. She was in a wheelchair, and you know, she got to play, I think, kind of like an evil woman. Too.
Oh my God, the one who gave her the apple?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's right.
It wasn't even just like her writing her in where it's just like, oh, she's like a sad woman in a wheelchair. She's like, no, you're going to be a fucking bitch in a wheelchair.
Yeah. Feed me this apple, sedate me in my sleep. I'm going to solve this crime. Were you the one who did? Oh, that was a good one.
We asked Rocketeers to call our Angela Appreciation Hotline to share any stories they had. And Stephanie told us about an encounter she and her family had with Dame Angela a couple of summers ago. We had to edit the call for time, but here's what she had to say.
"For my daughter's entire life, when we watched Murder, She Wrote, I've told her that when Mrs. Fletcher waves at the beginning of the show, that she's waving at her. When my daughter actually saw Angela Lansbury, she was 9 at the time. She burst into tears and started laughing and crying and she couldn't talk, and she just went over to her and gave her a huge hug, and Angela Lansbury was so wonderful about it. She could not have been more gracious and kind. I have pictures of her with me, with my mom, and with both my children. It was a magical night, and I couldn't have scripted it better. Thanks.
The wonderful thing about somebody who's been famous for a really long time is they understand how to be famous, you know? Yeah. And how to, like, manage and handle the fan interactions. Anytime I see somebody who's being a dick to somebody recognizing them, it's like, there are a lot of people who are more famous than you who have never been dicks to people. Mm-hmm. It's not that hard to go through the airport, Sarah. You guys don't know which Sarah I'm talking about, but I know which Sarah I'm talking about. All right, well, please get in the Facebook group and tell us who your favorite Angela Lansbury was. Have an argument about whether she was robbed for the 1962. Was she? Do we feel like she was robbed for the
1962? There's no argument. She was. That's sort
she
of
was,
a final story.
But she was very happy that she didn't get it because it would have. She thought that it would have cursed her career.
Mm-hmm. you're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back right after this.
Have you ever watched a movie so bad you just needed to talk to somebody about it?
Well, here at the Flophouse, we watch a bad movie and then talk about it.
Yeah, you don't have to do anything. We'll watch it and we'll talk it. We do the hard work.
Featuring the beautiful vocal talents of Dan McCoy,
Stuart Wellington,
and me, America's Rascal, Elliot Kalin.
New episodes every other Saturday at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts, dude. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Brennan. With me in the studio are
Margaret Wappler,
Karen Tongson,
April Wolf,
S.A. Smythe.
And S.A. Smythe just burned me real hard about how old I am during the break.
That's
so
untrue.
Be aware of that.
I love the Rocketeers.
Now, every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what is your current jam? So I turn to you, April Wolf.
Oh, that's me.
Yes, it is.
I started yawning and I was like, I've got to hold that back.
what is your current jam?
My current jam is an old jam.
Okay.
It is Marlene Dietrich singing Such Trying Times. Mm. And I picked it because it's thematically, I mean, aside from just being a thinking, breathing human and loving Marlene Dietrich, it's the fact that John Mervyn Addison, who composed the song for Murder, She Wrote, also composed the music behind this song.
Bob.
A man I know is falling for me. A man I know is acting like a fool, while I remain as cool as ice. This man I know keeps calling for me. This man I know is acting far too grand. Why can't he understand? He's throwing losing dice. Such trying times, such trying times. Why do we live in such exasperating times?
I love it when Marlena, like, speaks English and she brings all of that, like, those trying times.
Oh,
like,
yes.
Her German accent, you know? Love it.
Oh, God, I love her so much.
It's my whole gender identity right there.
Yeah. I think it's a good one to
yeah,
just
Blue
shape
Angels?
Yourself around.
I mean, put another episode on this person here. Ugh, for days.
Tongson, you got a jam?
I do, and it's something that's kind of weird for me because I'm usually ideologically opposed to dude-feeling music from Brooklyn.
Yes.
And
it's one of the things I like most about you.
But all to say, I am completely, totally always taken in by it. Basically, that is the content of my soul, even though I loathe to admit it. And this is one of the songs that I've really enjoyed in the last year. It's by the Dirty Projectors, and it's called What Is the Time from their 2018 album, Lamplit Prose.
What is the time when I can call you by your name? I don't know why it's been so long. I'll only imagine nobody. Once in a while, well, I guess the planets align and show me the one I am. I am.
me harmonies and horns, and basically I'm yours.
And also my own kombucha.
Maybe a little hint of a man bun.
Isn't it Neo Blue Eyed Soul?
It is very.
It's like Neo Soul, but Neo Blue Eyed
Soul.
It is
so Neo Blue Eyed Soul.
He's white shenanigans.
And that is the thing. It's just so. It is. It's like super white shenanigans, but I'm like, damn, why do I like it so much?
Yeah, it's all right.
Like R&B falsetto is being gentrified, you know?
Yeah, he's definitely interested in R&B and then just sticking it into the whitest context.
Oh, he should just do Dio then if he wants to do a falsetto. We need more Dio sounds.
Or some Cetera.
Redlining the album.
Essay.
Oh, no. As I just finished shading white people for the gentrifying music.
Do you have a jam?
I do. So in support of Black liberation. So my song is from the 1946 musical Till the Clouds Roll By, featuring Dame Angela Lansbury. It's a sustained contradiction.
It's called disidentification.
Thank you so much, Jose Munoz. Thank you so much.
Yes. So,
Black Power. So in this 1946 musical, Dame Angela Lansbury really nails the choreography. She's around 21. She's a Libra, which is okay. So she's about to be 21 in the filming of this musical. The choreography is fantastic. It's called Would You Like to Spoon With Me? I am not saying that I've sent it to people that I fancied, but I'm also not saying that.
How'd you like to spoon with me?
I'd like to.
How'd you like to spoon with me?
Well, rather.
Sit beneath an oak tree, large and shiny. Call me little Tootsie, Wootsie, baby. How'd you like to wag and squee?
Indeed, I would.
Dangle me upon your knee.
I could.
How'd you like to be my lovely darling? How'd you like to?
Guy, it slaps.
Magwaps.
Yes, darling.
You got a jam?
I do. It is from Solange, who we already touched on earlier in the episode. This is a song, Bins, from the new record, When I Get Home, and this is a collaboration with Panda Bear. She has a lot of really interesting people that she pulled into this album, like The Dream and Sampha and Pharrell.
I do want to mention how she brought Black Planet back. Anybody?
Oh, wow.
Right? She announced the album on a Black Planet page, which was incredible.
That
no one's
is
been
incredible.
Using Black Planet, now everyone's on it again.
This is the one track that she has with Panda Bear, and it's it bounces. It gets into your head.
I just want to wake up to the suns and say no $100,000 on the fronts and the blunts. I just want to wake up and get that. Only at in the rows that's rented, windows tinted. We got a big spinning, big spinning. I'ma get back on my feet, give me a minute. I'ma feel this in my thighs, like even in it. Young summer, give me a minute. Sundown when chimes, break it down.
I would hold on to the chorus, but there is no chorus.
Ah, tantric pop. That's what I'm looking for.
7 hours of downward dog.
Ass is a hell of a drug.
In more ways than one.
From 7 hours of downward dog to not quite 3 minutes of not quite ecstasy. Swisher, roll it.
I'm a sucker for you.
You guys, the Jonas Brothers are back, and we could
Joe Bros.
We could be sad that they're not being experimental or journeying the way that Demi or Ariana have. I like that they know what their job is. I like that they do their job. I like that they are good at their job. Mm. The point is, I love you, Jonas Brothers. Thank you for coming back. Right. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Brown, Margaret Wappler, Karen Thompson, and our two very special guests. If Wolf, where can people learn more about you?
Usually on Twitter, because I don't have a job, so I'm just doing stuff.
Can they listen to your podcast?
They can listen to my podcast. It turns out it's on Max Fun.
Okay.
Yeah, it's called Switchblade Sisters, and I'm also on Ricky Carmona's podcast, Who Shot Ya?
Also, I'm not sure how Maximum Fun is supported. Do you know?
It's supported by listeners like you.
Yes.
Ding, ding, ding. Right? Right.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure that's the model.
And like, people supporting Maximum Fun, that helps your podcast and my podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And keeps you somebody who's in the family so that we can, like, call you in on special occasions like this when you can do the heavy hitting.
Yeah, yeah, it's great.
Along with the other heavy hitter of the day, S.A. Smythe. S.A., where can people learn more about you?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm also on Twitter. Literally only tweet about white supremacy and Murder, She Wrote at S.A. Smythe, E-S-S-A-Y-S-M-Y-T-H-E. I teach on colonialism at UCLA. And thank you so much for fulfilling my podcast dreams.
Okay. Thank you, both of you, for fulfilling ours, of having two true experts on a person we all love. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. This week, we'd like to thank Sarah Liz. There are a lot of H's in there. They say, I really enjoy the show, and Guy is the best. That's very sweet. Thank you. Allie0009 said, I've been a big fan of Guy Branum since listening to him on Do You Need a Ride, then indulging in Talk Show the Game Show, RIP. Look, we're all sad about that. I was aware of this podcast, but for some insane reason, only started listening and subscribing last week. Now, all my days are delightful, being able to go all the way back and binge listen to all the back episodes. Love y'all and what y'all do. Forever grateful, Allie. There's two very solid reviews.
She's got a good billboard waiting for her on Sunset Boulevard. Allie.
If you want us to hear your feedback or even ask a panelist for advice, you can call 530-237-4108. My mom is standing by the phone. The Angela Appreciation Hotline is now closed, but the Pop Rocket Appreciation Line is always open, so don't be afraid to call. Get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and get in the discussion. We've also got the Instagram account that I never remember the name of.
At Pop Rocket Podcast.
Get on it. We're a production of MaximumFun.org. This episode was edited and produced by Laura Johanna Swisher.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.